Welcome, everybody. This is the third office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics. This is the spring 2012 edition, and I am going to be, let's see here. Can you see? I want to be writing stuff on the dry erase thing here. Here we go. Okay, so I turn on the whiteboard. Let me just see how this works. Because per Danny Sanchez's suggestion, he's saying the only way I'm going to get conversant with this stuff is if I use it. And so he was suggesting that even during these office hours that I start doodling things on the side here. So it's going to be a little bit contrived, especially this session since I'm doing it for the first time. But anyway, the point is, if those of you who have seen, you know, Khan Academy, that sort of thing, you know, it really does enhance that guy's lectures besides him just talking at you that he's doodling stuff. And so I am going to try to force myself to be doing that. So anyway, the point is you're going to see me tonight doing stuff like that, even though at times it might seem like there's no reason he needed to write that out. But it's mostly the more I do it, the more natural it'll become. Okay, so the first question was from, I think it was Susan that emailed me this, so I'll go ahead and, she wasn't sure if she was going to make it, so I think her plan is for me to say it, to answer her question, and then she'll listen to the recording. Okay, so she says that Dr. Woods, referring to Tom Woods, in his lecture, Myths and Facts About Big Business, quoted Mises referring to the pre-capitalist difference between rich and poor being the difference between traveling in a coach and four or traveling barefoot, and comparing that to today's difference between rich and poor being the difference between driving a late model Cadillac and a secondhand Chevy. He was making the point that the difference was less today because of bigness in business. Would not the Jared Bernsteins of the world say that reduced difference is evidence that minimum wage law has helped unskilled laborers, and how would you respond to that? Okay, first of all, I know exactly what she's getting at, but some of you might not understand. So, first of all, Tom Woods was quoting Mises, and what his point was, Mises was addressing this issue of, does capitalism just serve the rich? Right, because that's one standard rhetorical ploy or theme of people who want to attack laissez-faire capitalism, is they kind of have to concede that it works pretty well. That capitalism is an efficient system; it's good at taking resources and cranking out products and services. Right? I mean, incidentally, just to note, that wasn't always the case, right? Back before, you know, like in the late 1800s, the socialists claimed, or at least many of them did. I can't say that I surveyed the whole literature and can speak about proportions and so forth, but certainly there was an element of socialist theoretical thought that argued that everybody would be richer under socialism than under capitalism, right? That And in case you're wondering, like, well, how could they even postulate such a silly thing? Well, because they would say, you know, gee, under capitalism, it's crazy. You've got all this redundancy. You know, you've got all these different, in our times, they wouldn't have said this back in the 1800s, but in our times, you've got all these different sneaker companies. And they're advertising, like Nike's trying to get you to buy Nike and Reebok's trying to get you to buy Reebok and so forth. Okay? So that's the So if nothing else, you know, having socialism where the government owns all the means of production and produces everything, it would reduce all this wasteful competition. Okay, so that was one of the supposed arguments in favor of socialism and why it would be more efficient. Okay, so with the history of the 20th century and seeing things like that and just looking at the actual results, that argument has sort of lost its prominence. And so not, you know, by the mid-20th century, the knock against capitalism had shifted. Now it was not that capitalism wouldn't produce enough stuff for the workers and for the people, but now it was, oh, capitalism is all about crass materialism. In a sense, capitalism produces too much stuff. Capitalism's fault is that it makes us think that the amount of goods we have per capita is the important thing in life, right? So, I mean, it's always, capitalism is always evil, but the reason for it is being awful change over time, you know, if you're an anti-capitalist critic. So anyway, what Mises was trying to show here is that the people who were claiming that, okay, yeah, capitalism is an effective way to deploy resources and to crank things out, but look, it just caters to the rich. So yeah, a capitalist system is great if you're a millionaire, but if you're, you know, some poor slob on the street or even just a guy who works in a factory, then capitalism is a horrible system, right? And so so against that perspective, Mises pointed out that, whoa, let's keep some historical perspective here. There really was a class system in the pre-capitalist feudal period, okay? There really were different layers of society or, you know, just different worlds, and then those people barely interacted with each other. And so the point being that back in those days, when it comes to transportation, the rich went around on a coach pulled by four horses, whereas the poor person, it wasn't like, oh, the poor person only had a coach with one horse, or he had a coach with four horses that weren't very pretty or weren't very strong. No, there really wasn't a middle class, as part of the point. The lower classes, they got around by walking, right? So the gap there between those two things was just qualitative. And then it was with capitalism and the introduction of mass production for the masses, where now the capitalists, you know, the titans of industry and so forth, what did they do? That's an important phrase. Let me write that out. Mass production for the masses. Right. So mass production is a hallmark of the Industrial Revolution, and it sort of goes hand in hand with this notion of a modern capitalist society, an industrialized economy. You know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The industrialism was like the epitome of capitalism, whereas now for us, capitalism is more like the, you know, information technology, and industrialism is like a second world country or something. But the point was, with Henry Ford, you know, mass producing cars and all the other car companies coming on the scene, certainly by, you know, the 1950s, at that point, there really was a solid middle class, and the difference between the rich and the middle class or even the lower classes was not this qualitative thing. It was now just, the rich, you know, the upper class drove a nicer car than the lower classes did. But you see, so Mises' point there, that the distinctions between class and so, yeah, there are still rich people and poor people, but the point is capitalism has so greatly improved the quality of life of the lower classes that now, I mean, the difference between the two is nothing like it used to be. I mean, it really did used to be there were a group of people that were elites, and they just lived in a different world. And then there was all the rabble out there that were struggling to survive, and that fundamentally changed with the advent of what we know of as modern capitalism. And so this phrase, the mass production for the masses, Mises is pointing out there that the hallmark of capitalism is mass production, and people, you know, are horrified by that, and they think they long for the, you know, Marxists might pine for the day when, you know, people, artisans and craftsmen and so forth, would just with their bare hands or just, you know, maybe small tools, would make individual things, and people decry mass production. But Mises' point is here, if you're mass producing something, who are your customers? It's not the elites, it's the masses. By definition, you're not mass producing something intending to sell to 15 barons. You're mass producing something intending to sell it to the proletariat, to use Marxist terminology. So, and it was mass production that made the so-called titans of industry, or the robber barons, if you will, right? You don't turn into a robber baron. You don't become a billionaire by selling individualized products to other rich people. You become a billionaire by making something that millions and millions and millions of people want. And so these so-called robber barons got into their position by figuring out better ways of serving millions of people, because that's really where the money is if you're a business person, right? Zuckerberg, why is Facebook so rich? Because, you know, how many people use that thing? 1 billion people? You know, if he had made some really elite thing that only, you know, A-list celebrities could log into, and they might be cool, like, oh, wow, you know, imagine, so, like, the Olsen twins can log in here and just hang out with other real cool people, and there'll only be like 1,000 people total on Earth that can log into this thing, and it'll be so exclusive. Think of how much we can charge people. That'd be crazy. No, instead, he makes the thing free, and then makes it so that everybody wants to get on it, and then people advertise, and that's how, you know, that's why it's worth so much. So now that I've talked a little bit about the context here, so Susan then asks, okay, so given that that's Mises' point, and Tom Woods had echoed that, made that point, so now she comes and says, well, wouldn't somebody like Jared Bernstein, who's, what the heck was he? I forget what his, was he in the, I don't know if he was in the council. I think he was like the head economist for Biden or something like that. I mean, he was in some capacity in the Obama administration as an economist, and it's, I'm not confident right now as to what his actual position was. I think he was the chief economist for the vice president's office, but I could be off about that. But anyway, he's obviously big now on inequality and that kind of stuff. And so she's saying, wouldn't he point to this reduction in the gap between the rich and the poor and say, oh, yeah, that just proves that the minimum wage law has done a good thing to help unskilled laborers and so forth. Okay, well, there's two issues there. One is, I don't think Jared Bernstein would agree with Mises, or I'm not sure that he would. What I am 100% sure of is that Jared Bernstein would not volunteer, you know, on his own. He wouldn't go out of his way to say, by the way, it's a good thing the Industrial Revolution and modern capitalism has really just showered prosperity on the lower classes. And yeah, sure, it helped rich people, but really, I think the hallmark of modern capitalism is that it helps the poor. I don't think Jared Bernstein would be volunteering that perspective. Okay, so I don't think, so Susan's trying to say, like, wouldn't he try to spin that historical fact to further his own, or not to line up with his own policy prescriptions, but I'm not even sure he would concede that historical fact. What Bernstein and Krugman and guys like that talk about is they'll say, you know, in the United States, they'll tend to focus on the 20th or the late 1800s and then through the present, and they'll say back in those dark days of the so-called Gilded Age, you guys probably heard that in your U.S. history class, is, so here, I'm not endorsing this perspective, but this is the kind of thing you would hear, that yeah, back then, before the federal government was very strong, it was basically laissez-faire in the United States. And so you had this upper class that basically could operate with impunity, and they just did all sorts of crazy stuff, and workers had no protections, and so you had this Gilded Age where, yes, there was great, fabulous wealth side by side with unconscionable poverty and terrible working conditions, and it was just horrible. And then, thank goodness, we had the rise of the progressive movement, where we started laying down some basic regulatory prohibitions or safeguard standards. And then the height of, I guess, egalitarian perfection, or the closest to an egalitarian society that the U.S. ever came was like in the post-World War II era, where we happened to have really high marginal income tax rates, like 91% on the top bracket, and strong unions and a lot of regulation and stuff like that. And that was probably like the best decade or two in U.S. history, all things considered. Right? And then we made the fateful decision, the rise of Milton Friedman and all these free market apostles. Ronald Reagan comes in, cuts tax rates. We get all this wave of deregulation in the late 90s and under the Bush administration. And then what happens? Now we're smack dab in the middle of the next Great Depression. And if you look at the statistics, the income inequality measures soared under the Reagan administration through the present. And so, whereas they had been much better, like in the 1950s, and so that's the narrative that Jared Bernstein, I think, is going to be pushing, and for sure Paul Krugman has hopped on board with that. And so, anyway, I'm telling you the way I think they would spin. So I don't think they would try to take credit for their. I don't think they would agree that there's a better income distribution now than in the past. I think they would say there's a terrible income distribution now compared to what it was in the 1950s. And to the extent that you started pushing them to the past, I think the furthest back they would go or would want to take the discussion would be, oh yeah, back in the Gilded Age, when we had at that point also very little regulation at the federal level for sure. On business, and look at how unequal the wealth and income distributions were at that point, and look at all these horrible anecdotes I can point to you about living conditions back then for the poor. So clearly, if you're a laissez-faire capitalist person now, that means you don't really care much about poor people, do you? Okay, Dominic says, I wondered about one of the quiz two questions. It was, quote, is it possible to imagine a society which has a medium of exchange but no money? So this is now back to Dominic talking. Here's my train of thought on the question. Barter would be direct exchange and thus would not classify as having a medium. Thus, if a medium of exchange was being used, indirect exchange would be being engaged in. Now, if a society had a medium of exchange, then this would be exactly synonymous with the definition of money that you provide in The Young Economist. A widely or universally accepted medium of exchange. So whether they use dollars or chicken eggs, they would be using money. If the medium of exchange was only accepted here and there, this might not qualify as money, but as society appeared in the wording of the question, it led me to believe that the medium of exchange in question, whatever it was widely accepted. So I answered no. Okay. All right, well, unfortunately, The question was supposed to be tricky, but not for the reason you just pointed out. So let me clear this. Okay. Just for those who are listening, I'm just clearing off the dry erase board. Okay, so I get now what you're saying, and you're right. I should change that in the future. Let me just write a note to myself so I don't forget that. So what I was trying to get at, remember, what is the medium of exchange? A medium of exchange, you're right. A medium of exchange, remember, is a thing. It's an object that's being exchanged. But the point is someone accepts it with the intention of trading it away again. That's what makes it a medium exchange. And then that also is what constitutes an indirect exchange. So you're right. If there's an indirect exchange, a medium of exchange is involved. Whereas if it's a direct exchange, then there's not the use of a medium of exchange. So you're right with that. So what I'm trying to get people to realize is that, so all money is a medium of exchange. But not all media of exchange are money. Okay, so again, Dominic, the way you were analyzing your answer would have been right. It's just that's not what I meant. So I'm just now walking through the question to make sure everyone understands the subtleties. Okay, so it's again with this thing, it's like all poodles are dogs, but not all dogs are poodles. Okay, so you know what a medium of exchange is. Now, if it's a medium of exchange that is accepted by just about everybody, then that is a money. Okay, so what I meant, Dominic, I was trying to say, can we imagine a situation where there is a medium of exchange but no money? And I just said society, just like to say, you know, like, can we imagine a world where this is true? I mean, that's what I meant by the word society. I didn't mean, can we imagine a society where every single person accepts the same medium of exchange? Because look, if I really wanted to be tricky, I could say, can we imagine a society where each person accepts something as a medium of exchange and yet there's no money? And the answer is yes, if you understand that what the way I phrased that I meant, but not necessarily, but the medium of exchange is not necessarily the same for each person. All right, so there could be so you could have, so, you know, you got, this is really going to get silly. You got a bunch of people. Okay, and then, like, this guy here, he accepts a medium of exchange, right? So in other words, if he's trading with people and he wants to get rid of something for steak and he can't find a butcher that wants the thing that he has, he's willing to accept something in the meantime. And what he's willing to accept is, you know, a can of tuna fish. That's what that is. In case that's not obvious, it's a can of tuna fish, right? These two guys over here, they're willing to accept apples as the medium of exchange, right? But they won't accept tuna fish. The only time they would accept tuna fish is if they wanted to eat it, right? They wouldn't accept tuna fish though with the intention of trading it away. Whereas they would trade things for apples, even if they don't want to eat the apples, that they intend to trade it away to somebody else. They're like, oh yeah, an apple is actually a pretty marketable good. I run into lots of people that use apples and accept them in trade. So since I can't find a better buyer for my stuff right now, sure, I'll sell it to this guy for some apples because I'll probably be able to unload these apples down the road. All right, and then this guy accepts bananas, and then these two people accept, well, I don't know what, bars of gold. Okay, so in this society that I just drew here, every single person accepts a good as a medium of exchange, but there is no money. There's no single good. There's no single medium of exchange that is widely or universally accepted. Okay, so that's the distinction there I was trying to make, but I see, Dominic, what you mean, that since I said since a society accepts it, I think I did change the wording, and now I see it's still not great, because I think what happened was, I think the first time I taught the class, I think the question was worded, is it possible that there's a medium of exchange that's accepted in society, and yet it's not money. And then people thought I meant accepted by everyone, so I further clarified. So here, I mean, the society does have it. I mean, I could say, does our society right now have a sports stadium, or does our society right now have a Mises Institute? And we could say, yeah, sure. Does that mean everyone in society owns the Mises Institute? Well, no. You know, Lou Rockwell owns it, or whoever the shareholder, I don't know who owns it, but you get what I'm saying. So I was trying to say, does a society have a medium of exchange? I meant just, is it true that there's a medium of exchange that exists within this group of people? But I do see why that was unnecessarily confusing, and I'll figure out a better way to phrase that for the next class. Okay. By the way, everybody, be thinking of more questions here, because after I answer the next one from Dominic, I think that we'll have exhausted all the pending questions. So, and it's not going to take me half an hour to answer this question. Okay, Dominic says, also, I was thinking about employee protection via the system of entrepreneurship and free market capitalism. The wage protection that you laid out for employees makes sense to me, but I wondered how you would answer someone like Upton Sinclair, who would point to horrible, possibly exaggerated, I don't know, working situations like he chronicled or dramatized in The Jungle and say, the government needs to protect workers. What does free market capitalism do about awful working conditions? Okay, really good question. Let me give myself a blank slate. Okay, so for people who don't know what he's talking about, there was this famous book, Upton Sinclair's, The Jungle. And it was the story of an immigrant family, and I think the guy went to, I mean, I know it was about a meatpacking plant, but I'm trying to remember, is it that the protagonist worked there? Like, was that the literary vehicle that allowed the reader to learn the conditions? I think so, but I'm not certain about that. But anyway, the novel just goes through and depicts these horrendous things, like so people are working at a meatpacking plant, and it's just disgusting stuff, like everything's going into the you know, the meat that's getting packaged and sold to consumers in this plant. Anything that falls in there gets sold. It's not like they stop the machine and take stuff out. So that includes like rat droppings getting in there, and like if the rats themselves go in there, so be it. And then I think the grossest one is like some guy, you know, is using the machinery and there's an accident, and like his hand gets chopped off and falls in the thing, and nope, keep going. Right, so the point is somebody now in America is eating that guy's hand unknowingly because it went into the thing. So didn't have federal regulation, businesses would just cut corners. Because it wasn't that the people who owned the meatpacking plant were sadistic. You know, it wasn't like they were engaging in satanic rituals and wanted people to be eating human flesh. It was that it would be expensive, right? If you had a bunch of meat that was, you know, already mixed up or whatever and was about to get packaged, and then something fell into it and they had to stop, and, you know, what would they do? Throw out all that meat because now it was contaminated, you see? So the point was, if you have these people that are who just care about money, and you know, narrow pecuniary profit motive to the exclusion of everything else, and hey, that's what capitalism rewards, then you're going to get these disgusting outcomes. And so the point that most people would take away from reading that book would be, oh, phew, you know, I can't believe back then people had such a limited view of the role of government. Thank goodness, because of Sinclair and other writers and agitators in the progressive movement, now we have, you know, much more responsible governments and so forth, and all these very necessary restrictions on what businesses can do to ensure minimum standards of product safety for the consumer, but also workplace safety to make sure the employees don't, you know, have to choose between getting laid off or working with machinery that's very dangerous and could chop their hand off or something like that. Okay, so that's the thing. So a couple points. One is Sinclair himself was a socialist, right? He wrote the book to try to get people to see that capitalism was an evil system, and he later said something like, this might not be an exact quote, but something like, so he was disappointed that it didn't lead to socialism, but instead just led to, you know, government regulation. And he said something like, I intended my book to change the hearts and minds of America, but instead I just turned their stomachs. Right? So he was trying to enlighten people and get them to see, oh, capitalism is just not a good system, that's why we should all be socialists. And instead they just read it and went, oh, that's disgusting, the government should pass laws about those meat packers, right? And so that's that point. The other thing is, he made that stuff up, right? I mean, they had, I can't off the top of my head remember why I'm so confidently telling you that. I mean, I've read historical, you know, I've read historians trying to argue the point that Upton Sinclair just made that stuff up. And I remember that being convinced that, yeah, that there really was no evidence that that kind of stuff happened. I mean, certainly wasn't like he went undercover and saw that stuff with his own eyes. You know, he made up the stories, and then in terms of what evidence do we have as to what was actually going on, you know, it's not like there was eyewitness testimony from people. So, I mean, having said all that, would I rather eat a pound of hamburger made today or that came out of Chicago in the year 1902? I'd rather take the meat that was made today. But by the same token, I would rather drive a car that was made today. I would rather read math books that were printed today. And I would rather go to a doctor today and so forth. It doesn't, you know, the fact that things are better now by itself doesn't prove that it's the result of government intervention. It's just showing that's the progress of free market capitalism, or relatively free market capitalism. People were poor back then, and there's trade-offs. So, you know, why wouldn't those business owners just on their own install equipment that was safer, right? Why would they have their workers come in and use machinery that if you weren't paying attention, you could get your hand chopped off? Is it because the business owners were really misanthropes and they actually hated their workers and were just like sitting in the back office taking bets on who's going to get his hand chopped off first? No, it's because it was cheaper. It was more profitable to do that than to, you know, think of it this way. When the government came in and laid down these regulations that would make the workplace safer and so forth, the businesses were probably like, oh, man, because now they had to spend money, right? So the point is, there was a constraint. It wasn't like they were forcing the businesses to do something that made the businesses more money, at least in the short term. That there were compliance costs. Or another example would be a famous thing was this fire. I think it was called the Shirtwaist Triangle Factory fire, or something like that. It was a famous thing. I talked about it in my book, and just the name. I might be mixing up one of the adjectives, but it was this, you know, factory with all these garment workers in there doing, you know, piecemeal work, I think, and just, you know, cranking stuff out, and there was a fire, and there wasn't an adequate way to get the workers out of the building, and so a bunch of people died, and the issue was, you know, and so then that led to a bunch of regulation about you got to have ways of getting people out of the building and so forth. So regulations that nowadays we take for granted, but back then it wasn't illegal to be operating a business where, well, gee, you know, look at this place with all these workers you got in here. If a fire ever broke out in the middle of a shift, I bet you a lot of people would die because there's not enough, you know, there's not enough exits and there's no fire escape or whatever. So how do you deal with that kind of stuff? So again, the first thing is to say, is not to just try to whisk it away and say, oh, no, those things are all fantasy. No, the living conditions really were bad back in the Industrial Revolution or whatever compared to today. Obviously, our standard of living today is much higher, and part of how that manifests itself is that when we go to a job, it's a lot less dangerous now than it used to be, right? That's one of the ways that we spend our wealth, is that we have much safer working conditions now. So think of it that way. You know, as a society gets wealthier and wealthier, what's it going to do? Well, one thing it does is it says, okay, our kids don't have to work anymore. And another thing it might do is say, okay, let's have air conditioning in the summer, and let's have our cars get air conditioning now, and let's eat more food, and let's do this. And then one of the things would be, let's spend money making workplace environments safer. Okay, so you can see there's these innovations, but they cost money. So the point is, there is a trade-off, and if a workplace is going to spend more money making the workplace safer or just more enjoyable, so like let's say it's a factory that gets really hot, and the government comes in, the inspectors will say, you know what, this is unconscionable, you need to put in some fans, or you got to put in an air conditioning unit, or you got to do, you know, stop and let the people take breaks every 45 minutes and get water with a water cooler and whatever, because right now these are inhumane working conditions. They can do that, but then that's going to cost money, not only just for the monetary outlay, but also like if taking those frequent breaks disrupts the production, for like if they got to, you know, stop the line and the machines while the workers take breaks or whatever, that can reduce profitability. Because again, if it didn't, then the businesses would do it on their own, right? Just to attract workers. If it didn't cost them more money to do something that workers would prefer, certainly over time you would expect the businesses to tend to do those things just to attract more workers. So ultimately, when it comes down to it, the business is trying to provide a total package to the worker, part of which is the paycheck, but there are other attributes too. And so if there's a chance your hand's going to get chopped off in this job working at the meat packing plant, or you could go over here and be a librarian where there's no chance your hand's going to get chopped off, well, other things equal, people are going to want to be librarians. Okay, and so when businesses are competing for workers, those things would play a role. So it's in the extreme case, I mean, we'll put it this way, I think people would realize, suppose the government, suppose, you know, the safety regulations in the year 1905 came in, and they insisted that all workplaces had perfectly adequate air conditioning installed to keep, you know, the temperatures within a narrow band, and the workers got full health care through age, you know, 90 if they lived that long, full pensions, and they got a car that their employer provided. And so, you know, let's say, would that be great? Would workers really benefit from that? Well, no, because no business could possibly operate. That would be way too expensive. Nobody could hire workers anymore. Everybody would be laid off, and everything would be black market. And so that would, you know, that would devastate the whole economy. Everybody would be poor if they did that. So if you can kind of get why being ridiculous and having them make just like a perfect dream job for every worker in America would actually be terrible for workers in America, once you see that principle, then you can start to see, then how would we even define what the proper place on that spectrum is? Because on the other hand, you could say, okay, fine, Murphy, but surely you wouldn't want there to be to be an outcome where every job you go to, there's a 10% chance you're going to die. You know, so because after a few weeks, everybody's going to be dead. So that'd be crazy too, right? So clearly, you know, it's got to be a happy medium somewhere, and we just have to trust that the FDA and the OSHA and these other government agencies strike a fair balance. And I'm saying, no, all we really just established is that a balance, that there exists a balance, that you can't have just perfect total safety on the job, but you also don't want to have complete danger on the job, and that the salary is one of the things that could change to help you know, pay for those stuff. Because if the employer is going to be paying more to put in fire escapes and to put in a sprinkler system and to put in air conditioning and whatever, and to allow for more frequent, for a longer lunch break, to pay for health insurance, then other things equal, your paycheck has to be lower. The employer can't pay you, you know, if the employer is going to be paying you your marginal productivity, per that argument from the textbook that I went over in the lecture, what I'm showing you here is it's not just that the employer is going to give you money. Part of what your compensation package is, you know, the amenities of the workplace environment and so forth. So the question is just now, given that you have a certain marginal productivity, how do you want to get paid in that? Do you want to take it in the form of just your paycheck and the job site's awful? Or are you willing to take a slightly lower paycheck, but then also have, you know, your portion of your thing docked so that the employer can afford to have a break room installed, to have a Coke machine, and to have, you know, bathroom breaks, stuff like that. So my general point is that there's no reason, I think, that having a federal agency overlooking all of these labor management bargaining processes is going to make things closer to where the ideal outcome would be. But I think letting people freely negotiate that stuff and having healthy competition among employers is the thing that will, in the long run, be most likely to strike that balance well. So it's true, in practice, a worker might not really think through the consequences and say, oh, this guy's offering me a lot of money to go work here. Let me go inspect the place and see if they have adequate fire escapes. But what I do think would probably end up happening in the absence of government regulation is that insurance companies would play a large role in this. So maybe like a standard clause would be that if you take a job here and you die on the job, then, you know, we're going to pay your family whatever, $100,000 compensation. And then the insurance company who backs me up as the employer, because like, I don't want to be hit with these random $100,000 payments, would then come and inspect my work site. Or if I'm a breadwinner and I have a personal life insurance policy, you know, that I know my family depends on my income, and so I take out a $500,000 term life policy on myself so that in case I die, my now widow and kids aren't destitute. Well, the insurance company who's going to underwrite me is going to be very curious to know what's your occupation. If I work in a coal mine, that means one thing. If I work in a meatpacking plant where there's a decent chance I'm going to fall into the machinery and get ground up, then they're going to charge me different premiums, or they might even just say, no, I'm not, you can't have that, our insurance policy, if you work for these guys. Right? So there are mechanisms that a market, I think, would evaluate risks where actual experts, so the insurance company would have statistics on this employer and would be able to say, well, no, this, we've had plenty of people die at this factory, so we're either going to charge you way higher premiums, and so take that into account when he's offering you a high paycheck, or we're just going to say outright, no, if you work for that guy, we're not giving you a policy, and then you would be a much more informed employee when looking at competing job offers, because the insurance company would be a big business too, with lots of actuaries and statisticians and and they'd have tons of case histories to evaluate these different risks that you might be exposing yourself to. So again, just to come down, there are trade-offs involved, and certainly the choices people would have made 100 years ago would strike us as incredibly reckless, but that's just because they were poor. Just like now, 100 years from now, people looking back at certain things that workers today tolerate, you know, working on an offshore oil rig is kind of dangerous. Being a taxi cab driver is really dangerous. And people 100 years from now might look back and say, oh my gosh, can you believe back before they had robots that would drive all the cars, there used to be people that would just drive around in inner cities at night and pick up random people who could then rob them at gunpoint. Can you imagine what it must have been like to be alive back in the year 2012? What a bunch of crazy savages, right? But you ask a cabbie now, why do you do that? He's going to say, well, because this is the best job I can get right now. Or, you know, it's the hours are real flexible, and this is what I need. Okay, got about 10 minutes left here. Susan Brown says, with the invisible hand metaphor that you mentioned in the first office hours, do you think desirable social outcomes would prevail in the absence of environmental regulation? What incentives could there be in the absence of regulation for a company with a toxic waste byproduct to refrain from damaging the environment? Okay, great question. I'm trying to think. Murray Rothbard has a nice essay on this kind of stuff. Oh, man, but it's just the name of his essay is escaping me at the moment. But anyway, the idea here is that the governments overruled the common law on this stuff. That what happened was historically, I don't want to give you dates because I'm thinking this happened like in the early 1900s, but don't quote me on that. I haven't read this sort of historical discussion in a while. But for sure, what happened is, you know, under the common law and the precedents and so forth, the way that property law had been brought to the United States, that you could, if you live downstream from a factory, you know, factories dumping stuff in the river, and that was something, you know, you would go out and that was what your drinking water was or whatever, that would get into your well or whatever, you'd wash your clothes in it or something, and all of a sudden, you know, your property is being harmed, or you hang your clothes out to dry and there's the factory down the street, and the soot from their smokestack, now when you hang your clothes up to dry, now your clothes get all dirty. You know, that's a violation of your property, or at least it seems like it could be. And so the point is, you could just like if somebody's walking onto your property and sits down and starts hawking lemonade, and you say, what are you doing? That's my front lawn. You can't just come and conduct your business on my property. Get off, right? And so there, it's not like, oh my gosh, we need a federal regulator to come in and pass a law restricting lemonade sales on people's front lawns. Like that's not something the federal government, it's just more, if you're violating my property rights, then I go to a judge and we deal with that. And so the same thing here. And then what happened is judges actually, you know, the governments sort of passed laws. And again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know the exact way this happened legally. But the point is, governments thought it would be impeding industrialization if we could have every little homeowner who you know, worried about smokestacks complaining and then stopping modern progress, modern industrialization, right? Because they thought it was a good thing that we have a factory that's employing workers and da-da-da-da, and we're, you know, having modern methods of production, and the fact that some lady down the river is complaining because her laundry gets dirty now, big deal. You know, how could we ever progress if every time somebody objected, that person could stop everything? And so that was the rationale, and again, I don't know the exact legal way they did it, but the point is, it's actually a form of government intervention to think that nobody owns the rivers or that the government does, right? Because that's another aspect of all this, too, is that, well, what are we worried about? We're worried about, like, you know, people dumping sludge out in the ocean or people polluting the pond, when if you really had a true private property framework society, somebody would own the oceans, or many people would own portions of the ocean, and people would own the pond, and people, you know what I mean? So it's a lot easier to understand how could a capitalist system without formal government regulations deal with that stuff when, you know, sort of like saying, well, what if somebody just came into my factory and started dumping paint on the floor? Don't we need a regulation against that? And it's more like you'd say, well, no, that would just be trespass. You know, so to the extent that you think the government has to be involved in enforcing laws and protecting private property, okay. But the point is, it's not like you would need some special body of law to deal with someone who comes into your factory and starts dumping paint on the floor. By the same token, if some company is dumping sludge into the river, well, the first thing to say is, well, who owns the river? The company that owns the river and that sells riverboat tours would take them to court. So you can't be messing with my property, and so they have to come to some arrangement. So it gets hard with stuff like global warming. You know, if the issue is, if I'm emitting carbon dioxide, which in and of itself, I can't point to some specific person who's harmed by that particular act, but we know collectively, if people keep doing this 50 years from now, glaciers are going to start melting and there's going to be millions of people who are adversely affected. If that really is the case in terms of the physical science, that's a much harder issue. But by the same token there too, it's also harder for governments to deal with that, because you need all the governments around the world to kind of be acting in unison to correctly deal with that. So my point is that is a tricky thing for markets to handle, as opposed to something easy like dumping sludge into a river. But by the same token, it's hard for governments to address that sort of problem, if that really is the situation we face. Okay. Also, Susan, a big thing on this is called the Coase theorem, which I'm not even going to address right now because it's kind of it's well beyond the sophistication of this particular course. But if you want to go Google that term and read some stuff on that, they do deal with it. So it's just to warn you, a lot of Austrian economists are wary of how some free market Chicago school types take this Coase theorem and apply it all over the place. But in any event, the discussion of what's called externalities and how do you deal with pollution and stuff like that is handled by this thing. So if you want to read more on not how Austrians talk about it, but how like free market Chicago school types talk about this stuff, if you Google Coase theorem and just start following those links, you'd probably see a lot of interesting discussion. Okay. Rhett says, hi, I was wondering if you could comment on Ayn Rand and Richard Duncan. Are they Austrian economists? What type of capitalist are they? I don't know who Richard Duncan is. Ayn Rand, I don't know if she ever called herself an Austrian economist, but she certainly was a fan of Mises, and she had kind things to say about him. I don't know how to classify her economics exactly, and I don't even know. I can't think of her having written something on economic theory per se for me to be able to say, oh yeah, here she clearly was influenced by Rothbard, or you know, oh here she's taking a Friedmanite approach to the Fed or something like that. Like I can't remember her ever writing something that was specific enough where I could get a sense of, has she read technical economics? But for sure, she thought Ludwig von Mises was a champion of liberty and was a great economist. But that's all I can really say. Rat says, is the American a free market capitalist economy? How far are we from the ideal? It depends how you define those terms. If you mean what I say right now in the United States, do we have a free market? No, I would say absolutely not. But by the same token, I don't think anywhere on planet Earth right now do we have a free market. So then if you say, okay, well then that term's kind of silly if it doesn't apply, I would say, well, it actually did kind of apply more in the past than it did now. And when you say how far are we from the ideal, I would say we're really far. That, you know, if you use as a measure how much does government spend out of total income, something like that, you know, how high of total GDP consists of government expenditures, it's pretty high. in the United States. So, and it's rising. Let's see. We got, so I think I can just look through these remaining questions here and give you really quick answers, and then we got to wrap it up. George Smith says, did you see the Paul debate? What did you think of Krugman as a debater? Do you still want to debate him? I did see it. I realize this might sound like I'm talking trash or something, but actually I was surprised at how badly Krugman did. I mean, and it's funny, I'm getting all these reactions from people making apologies for Ron Paul, like even ostensible Ron Paul fans saying, oh, yeah, he was kind of tripping over his work. Maybe it's just because I was so stunned by how badly Krugman did that I wasn't quote, but I thought, you know, I understood just their opening exchange. You know, Ron Paul went through his boilerplate stuff talking about, I'm against central planning. I want to have individual liberty. And it was fine. And then Krugman comes out and says something like, you know, first of all, he just rolls his eyes and scoffs like he's a teenage girl or something like that's his, you know, just like, do I even have to answer this? I mean, did you guys hear that garbage? You know, so that was kind of off-putting. But then he said, well, I mean, you have to have the Fed do something, right? Which, no, not if you want to end the Fed. What are you talking about, Krugman? That's the whole point. You know, it's sort of like if someone were debating socialism versus capitalism and the socialist guy just says, well, I mean, the government has to decide how much bread to produce, right? I mean, we can quibble about is it producing too many or too few loaves, but surely we have to have the government producing bread. You don't want everyone to starve. I mean, that was what Krugman did, which if you switch the context would be silly. And then he even said, I mean, you can go back. You know, what Paul wants to do is go back 150 years, but now we clearly need regulation of money. I mean, at this point, the financial market is so sophisticated, we don't even know the dividing line between where does money start and where does money end. So if you think about it, he's saying we need central planning and money because I can't even define what money is, and that's why the government should be running it based on my advice. That doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't prove that Ron Paul was right, but it does prove that Krugman's initial reactions to his opponent's opening statement were nonsense, all right? Like, even if you were a Keynesian, you should agree that, yeah, what Krugman just said was silly. It makes no sense. That he, you know, he should have just stood there and stared, and that would have been more effective than what he did. But anyway, so when you say, do I want to debate him? Yeah, I still want to debate him, but I actually think now that it would not be as, I don't think he would be as formidable an opponent now as I thought when I first made the challenge, and so probably wouldn't be as good. You know, before I thought I'd be fighting Darth Vader, now I think I'd be fighting a stormtrooper who was drunk. All right, that was somewhat of an exaggeration. I'd be fighting Jabba the Hutt drunk, who's less formidable than Darth Vader. Okay, one more, and then I got to stop here. Rhett says, hi, I was – oh, wait a minute, I got mixed up. Yeah, okay, one more. Rhett says, are the types of UN controls and regulations surrounding global warming anti-capitalist? How would an Austrian economist tackle such a problem? I don't know what you mean by anti-capitalist. I mean, they're huge. I would say they're huge interventions. Defenders of that stuff are going to say, well, given that the government does anything, these are just enforcement of property rights. In other words, they would argue the government is just introduced, if it has like a cap and trade program to limit carbon dioxide emissions, that's just enforcing property rights, because right now there's this huge missing market, if you will. Just like if for some reason we never had recognized land as property, you know, which we didn't originally, and that was the whole problem of the tragedy of the commons, and ranchers were letting their cattle graze on the land, and then the solution was to enclose it. Now we have private property and land, and that solved the problem. And right now, of course, governments are involved in enforcing property rights and land. And so the people, a lot of critics of libertarians are going to say, all we're doing here, we're assigning property rights. We're doing what you guys want us to do. What the heck is your problem? You know, if the climate science warning of catastrophe is correct, then there is a legitimate sense in which when you're belching CO2 into the atmosphere with your factory, you're hurting millions of people. And, you know, so if you think you shouldn't be allowed to dump poison into a lake, why should you be allowed to emit carbon dioxide in the atmosphere without internalizing that? So that's the argument. I've written something on that, Rhett. It's, I don't know if I've posted it. So if you email me, I can send you the thing. I've written on how would a worldwide free market respond if these climate models warning of catastrophe in 30 years if we don't act right now. Suppose that science is totally correct, and that there's no dispute about that. And so that, you know, what, because that could be true, right? In other words, if you're an Austrian libertarian kind of guy and you really hate the, you know, you don't want the UN to be regulating carbon dioxide emissions, probably a lot of what you're going to do right now is say, oh, the science isn't settled, and so on. But the point is, oh, you're going to, is that what you're going to hang your hat on? You're just going to say, well, I think it's because of the science, which you're not actually a qualified climate scientist, are you? And suppose it turns out the other way. Because you really don't know, and maybe new data comes in and new observations, and it does look like this is true. Then all of a sudden, are you going to be for the UN doing all this stuff? And so, just even strategically, that's one of the things I've been trying to do is to get libertarian opponents of this stuff to realize, look at if really why you're against it is you think that a government would abuse that kind of power and blah blah blah, then that should be your case. Don't be talking about you think the science is wrong if you know you don't really know what you're talking about, and certainly you don't want to make that the crux of your defense if deep down that's not really why you oppose it, because you know also because that's kind of dishonest rhetorically. Okay, well I gotta stop there, guys. So like I say, who asked me that? Was it Rhett? If you can send me an email just so I don't forget, and I can, and also I don't know what your email is. If you send me an email, then I can answer you and send you the thing I wrote. Okay, everybody, thanks for tuning in. And by the way, there was an issue with the quiz. I had it posted as of when it was supposed to be available, but I forgot to make it visible, so it was sitting there, and then it wasn't until this afternoon that somebody said, hey, that thing is invisible. Did you mean to make it visible? I'm like, yes, I did. So I apologize for that. If you were trying to take quiz 3, it is now open and visible. It was open the whole time, but now it's visible too, which is nice. Okay, thanks, everybody.